Good afternoon. Thank you all for being with us this afternoon here at CSIS, at the Global Health Policy Center. We're thrilled this afternoon to host Dr. Ward Cassells, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, and very grateful that he's found the time in his busy schedule to be here with us. I'm Steve Morrison from CSIS. I'm going to say about 60 seconds worth of opening comments and then turn the event over for opening remarks and moderation and introduction of Dr. Cassells to my great colleague Kathleen Hicks, who's doing a lot of work on the health and defense domain. A couple of housekeeping issues. There's some other exciting speaking opportunities coming up that I want to draw your attention to that are soon. William Steiger will be here January 12th. That's next Monday at 10 a.m. Here in CSIS. Pamela Barnes, the president and CEO of the Elizabeth Glaser Pediatric AIDS Foundation, will be here the next day, January 13th, at 11 a.m. Special focus of her remarks will be on mother-to-child transmission prevention and her vision of bringing that to scale. William Steiger will be reflecting on his experiences as the senior health advisor to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Ward Cates, head of Family Health International, and a prominent and known personality in global health. Ward Cates will be here February 5th at 3 p.m. Former Secretary Thompson will be here talking about his role in the neglected tropical diseases effort. We've had to reschedule that. It was going to be a little later in this month. Just pay attention to our website. We're talking to them about the new dates. It should be sometime late January, early February. The Center, Global Health Policy Center here at CSIS, we launched the end of September. We're still busy getting ourselves stood up. Our mission is really a pretty straightforward mission, which is to try to bring forward a sort of strategic long-term approach on global health, to bring forward new champions and new voices in the discourse around global health and what's at play, put a special focus on the security dimension, and put a special focus on the kind of partnerships that have been created around the world in new situations, including very difficult ones. Our speaker series is I think, one of our most important streams of activity. And we're striving, really, we've been putting a very special focus on attempting to get the leaders in global health from the Bush era to come and offer their reflections on this period of remarkable expansion of U.S. engagement and remarkable tests of what's possible and what's not possible in this period. We've had Mark Dival come and speak. We've had Secretary Leavitt come. The folks that we have coming next week. Peter Piot, at the conclusion of his tenure at UNAIDS, was here. And I think this is terribly important. And we're putting a very special focus. We'll hear more from Kathleen, putting very special focus on our work on the role that the Department of Defense has in this. This is an underappreciated, I think, from the standpoint of the global health community, it's an underappreciated but very important and rising dimension, and one that we need to think a lot more about. In the spring of this year, we will be launching a one-year effort out of the center, a commission on smart global health policy. It will be populated by 15 to 20 very prominent and predominantly Americans. And one of its key focal priorities will be looking at this whole question of U.S. Defense services, special assets, programs, authorities, and how to bring greater coherence and effort in that. I want to also thank and draw attention to one person who's with us here today, Emma Nicholson, Baroness of Winterbourne. Emma, welcome. Thank you for being with us today. Emma is a member of the European Parliament, member of the UK House of Lords, and an official with the Amar Foundation, which is an NGO active in Iraq and elsewhere in health and education and women's issues. She's a prominent voice and an active partner. And we're very happy that she's come and joined us. And again, I want to thank all of you for being with us today and ask Kathleen to do the honors of introducing. Thank you very much.
I'll echo Steve's thanks to everyone for coming today, and I realize I'm simply a speed bump on the way to the speaker you're really here to see, so I promise not to press upon your time too much. Steve has asked me to talk to you a little bit about what we're doing here at CSIS in terms of national security issues and health. And it's absolutely the case that global health and U.S. national security are inextricably tied. The health of populations overseas can affect nearly every aspect of American safety and prosperity here at home, from the stability of foreign governments and populations to the physical well-being of our own citizens. Yet global health-related programs and activities are not well coordinated across the U.S. national security community, nor oftentimes are they actually coordinated even within individual national security agencies. So Steve has asked us to take a look in the international security program, where we know much more about defense and national security than we do about health, at what the national security community is doing in terms of health. Probably the most interesting aspect is that the Department of Defense is a surprising addition to the growing list of global health advocates. The U.S. military is slowly evolving its thinking about global health issues as part of its overall recognition of the importance of non-military instruments of power. Many defense analysts view U.S. and Western efforts to improve the lives of populations overseas, especially if they're considered at risk for jihadist or other anti-American influences, particularly important. And although defense typically relies on other agencies for these soft power tools, it is a substantial contributor itself with authorities, resources, and programs that can offer promise for global health. In addition, DoD undertakes substantial biodefense research, outreach, and related activities that are significant. The way we are going about our work in global health and security is breaking it down into three major areas of activity. The first is extensive U.S. government biodefense and bioterrorism preparedness activities that are aimed at preventing the spread of infectious diseases or biological threats to Americans at home or our service members overseas. The second major area is efforts to reduce poverty and improve the health quality of foreign populations, and again, particularly for the national security community, for weak and failing states that are susceptible to outside influences. Third and finally, there are major programs led by the National Institutes of Health on developing medical countermeasures to potential exposure of U.S. citizens and livestock to disease. Now, the Defense Department, like the rest of the National Security Community, actually plays in all three of these areas, and I certainly won't walk through how it does so today. That's a lot of what our research is oriented on, talking about the authorities and the programs that fit under each of those categories. But suffice it to say that there are existing overseas development authorities that the Department of Defense can use, operations and maintenance funds that it can access for, if you will, support of humanitarian aid purposes. There are efforts, certainly substantial efforts, through its research labs, through GICE and other surveillance programs for biosecurity issues. And certainly in the countermeasures field, it's related most directly to the protection of service members, but there are obvious positive externalities that can grow out of that. I think just to conclude very quickly on this point, there is undoubtedly a growing tendency to view global health as a national security issue. And the real question starts to become to start to analyze whether that securitization of public health is actually occurring, and if so, whether it's a good or bad thing. We are here simply to help the task force that will grow out of the center's efforts grapple with that difficult issue. But suffice it to say that it is already quite clear, as I presaged in the first part of this talk, that the United States must have a strategy for global health that's nesting the security element fully within a holistic national and international approach, and that does not exist today. So we will be working with Steve and the other folks at the center and in support of the task force as they start to look at these issues. And for any experts in the room who'd like to provide their advice, we very much welcome that. Now, let me turn to the very pleasurable task of introducing Dr. Cassells. Dr. Cassells has led an extraordinary career in public health and public service. His expertise ranges from cardiology to disaster medicine and pandemic preparedness. He's a native of Wilmington, Delaware. He received his BS in biology from Yale and an MD from Harvard Medical School. In addition to service on educational, scientific, and charitable boards, Dr. Cassell served in several hospitals, advised public health enterprises, founded the Preparedness Organization Defense of Houston, and assisted in several major disasters. Most notably, as a colonel in the U.S. Army Reserve, Dr. Cassell assisted the Army's response to Hurricanes Katrina and Rita, for which he was awarded the Army Achievement Medal. He guided the Army's Avian Influenza Preparedness and received the Meritorious Service Medal. In 2006, he was deployed to Iraq as a liaison from Multinational Force Iraq to the Ambassador of Iraq. Most recently, in April 2007, he answered the call to service as the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Dr. Cassell.
Kathleen, thanks very much. Generous introduction. As we always say in Texas, we quote Lyndon Johnson, who after a particularly gracious introduction said, that's an introduction that my father would have appreciated and my mother would actually have believed. And I appreciate that introduction very much. It's a great honor, Steve Morrison, to be at CSIS. I've been to many talks here and have always been a fan of CSIS's even-handedness, particularly as regards defense issues. And I think it adds so much the way you have people on both sides of the aisle. And we at the Pentagon, of course, try to work so that our health efforts are not partisan, but rather mission-oriented and now increasingly global. But we pay a lot of attention to what is written at CSIS and to the meetings here. And, in fact, my interest in this position was triggered by one of your staff, Ray Dubois, who was telling me about it several years ago. So I'm grateful to him for that. And my wife used to work here. Years ago, she was a staffer here and then went on to a great career as a spokesperson for a whole variety of public figures. And so I asked her for advice about this talk. And she said, "Sweetie, they're all smarter than you are." And she said, is Nick Eberstadt coming? I said, "Yes, he's bringing several people from AEI." She said, "Then you might as well not speak at all." So, Mr. Eberstadt, delighted to see you. Ambassador Lang, thank you for being here. Mr. Rubenstein, all these famous people. Thank you very much. That concludes my remarks. Let me say, I do have, in order to avoid questions, I've got about 90 slides here. Is that okay? And I'll put this watch here. And you know the story, I think, of the bishop who came to the church and he buffed himself up and then with great ceremony, took his watch off and put it on the lectern, and the little girl said to her mother, "What does that mean that he's taking off his watch?" And the mother goes, "Absolutely nothing." But I will keep to the appointed time. And I do have, though, a few slides. The summary, for those of you who do have to leave early, let me just say, oops, that won't work. The title that Steve Morrison has given this, DOD's Increasing Role in Global Public Health, really is the gist of what I'm going to talk about. And I'll leave it to you to decide whether that is meritorious or not, whether that is really something that we should be doing with your taxpayer dollars or not. But it is something we're doing. We're doing it because the president asked us to, because the secretary reminded us to do, and so we are trying to develop this aspect of soft power, the sliver of soft power called medical diplomacy. And to that end, we have brought on board someone who you might not expect to lead this effort. It's not me, but we have a director of international health who was himself wounded, serving as a doctor in Iraq, wounded twice, went back again. He's not a quick learner, but he is dedicated. And That is Colonel Warner Anderson here. Dr. Anderson leads our Office of International Health, and is he's ready to explain any discrepancies in the slides. So we'll find out what he's got here for me to talk about. First, a few words about who the Defense Department health team really is. And we consider ourselves a leader, or at least a player, in healthcare, including research, education, and training. We've got a big budget, $42 billion. If you add in facilities construction, it often is, this year it'll be about $45 billion. We have about 137,000 employees. Today, I think every one of them is out of jail. No one's indicted. I'm always pleased when I read open the Washington Post and do not see my name or any of our staff. With that kind of budget and that size staff, there's always an opportunity for mischief. And this, so far in these 2 years, we have avoided that. We insure 9.2 million people through our insurance program called TRICARE. We took a hit 2 years ago with deficiencies in our outpatient care at Walter Reed Army Hospital. These were primarily not a function of the quality of health care, but rather of the frustrations of dealing with the Army bureaucracy and of getting disability benefits. Having said that, we have redoubled our efforts there, and in September, TRICARE, our program, was rated number one in patient satisfaction of all 22 American health programs. So we were obviously pleased to be up there, frankly, ahead of Aetna and Cigna and Medicare and the VA and other serious programs. We support about 240,000 people who are deployed today, counting all comers. This is a slide is just the active duty, 95,000. And we have an active research program, about 2,000 per year, publications per year, and that's increasing steeply. We're up about 40% over the previous year. Our mission is to provide optimal health services in support of our nation's military mission. Now, that is primarily soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen, and their families and the retirees. About two-thirds of those who served and have now retired are in our system, not in the VA system, so we have a large system. We have these overlapping spheres of activity, casualty care and humanitarian assistance. We've lumped them because they're both overseas. We strive to have a fit, healthy, and protected force, and healthy individuals, families, and communities. In the middle, we have an engine of research, education, and training, which produces the next increments in knowledge and in personnel. The military health system and global health has three broad goals. One is surveillance to protect our forward-deployed troops, and to provide early warning of some kind of catastrophe, natural, like bird flu, or man-made challenges. Secondly is winning hearts and minds in theaters of operation. Excuse me, you're not able to see there, are you, Major? In theaters of operation like Iraq and Afghanistan, and there are many others. In fact, in the last 40 years, the Defense Department has been really not so much involved in big wars, but in constant small conflicts interrupted by occasional large wars. This is a nonstop issue, these various theaters of operation, some of which we can't even talk about. Thirdly, building a bridge to peace, the long-term outcome of humanitarian activity and charitable aid to produce a safer and more secure world. The idea there is that we would like to intervene so that areas of crisis do not become regions of conflict. And as His Excellency Dr. Fatemi, the Minister of Health in Afghanistan, said in a recent visit, health is a part of this. In fact, how big a part is debatable, because health is both a consequence of security and prosperity, and arguably, we would argue, a contributor to security and prosperity. The Defense Department is given to acronyms, as some of you know. Now we talk about SSTRO or STRO, Security, Stability, Transition, and Reconstruction Operations. These are defined as operations intended to enhance infrastructure, improve practices, and extend services to areas where none of these exist. The idea is that by enhancing stability, we will reduce conflict. An example would be in the Gaza Strip, where not us, although we're giving quite a bit of humanitarian aid to the Gaza Strip in the last few weeks and before, but Hamas has made it a modus operandum to win hearts and minds primarily by the provision of health care, also education and a jobs program. But in the Gaza Strip, hardly anyone is employed, about half the population, rather, and yet they've won great allegiance by providing free health care. And this has been this is something that Hezbollah and our Chinese colleagues have used to great advantage as well. So this is a quote from Dr. Gates, my boss, and he says, "What is clear to me is that there is a need for a dramatic increase in spending on civilian instruments of national security, diplomacy, strategic communications, foreign assistance, civic action, and economic reconstruction and development." He's even recommended publicly that money be taken from my budget and given to Ambassador Lang's budget. Of course, I'm obliged to say, yes, sir. But specifically, he has said, it is odd that we have fewer foreign service officers than we have members of the military bands. So I have to say, I love a military band, but we do need more foreign service officers. General Caldwell, with whom I served in Iraq under General Casey, and we used to compete on the treadmill. I would run for about 5 minutes, and he would do the next 25. He is now in charge of our training doctrine and has come full circle, like our General Odierno, into advocacy of soft power as a leader in counterinsurgency activities. And he writes here, "The greatest threat to our national security comes not in the form of terrorism or ambitious powers, but from fragile states either unable or unwilling to provide for the most basic needs of their people. Military success alone will not be sufficient to prevail in this environment. To confront the challenges before us, we must strengthen the capacity of the other elements of national power, leveraging the full potential of our interagency partners." So this is not defense unilateralism, to be sure. This is a frank acknowledgement that we need help. Is DOD out of its lane? This has been asked frequently of me, particularly as we put more and more funds into both the counterinsurgency area and the humanitarian assistance and disaster relief areas. But we are obliged by DOD Directive 3000.05, issued under Secretary Rumsfeld, actually, that stability operations are a core U.S. military mission that the DOD will be prepared to conduct and support. They shall be given priority comparable to combat operations and be explicitly addressed and integrated across all DOD activities, including doctrine, organizations, training, education, exercises, material, leadership, personnel, facilities, and planning. The health aspect of this is given to our office. Now, there are people who say, well-meaning people, that DOD should not be in the lane of USAID and the State Department. And there are people who love to put that in the op-ed pages. We scratch our heads about this because it's completely clear to the Defense Department that the state has the lead. They are the chief of mission wherever we are. USAID has the lead role in reconstruction. But we have more personnel. And when you have more personnel, you can have people with very specific talents, not just lifting logs to build schools, not just pouring concrete to build clinics, but we have some people who have a lot of training in this area. And when this was posed, this question was posed in Britain, Colonel Sir William Butler answered, "It is needless to say that Charles Gordon held a totally different view of the soldier's proper sphere of action, and with him the building part of a soldier's profession was far more important than the breaking part. The nation that will insist upon drawing a broad line of demarcation between the fighting man and the thinking man is liable to find its fighting done by fools and its thinking done by cowards." Well, that's boldly stated. Today, we are trying in the Defense Department to acquire nuance. Nuance is a byword of the new administration, and scheduled to stay on with the new administration, I'm trying to acquire nuance. My wife pointed out that I don't do nuance, and I've asked around. I sent it out for coordination, and I got back from the lieutenant colonels and the colonels this answer: "Nuance, sir, we probably can't afford it. It's hard to spell, and we don't know anyone who's ever fired it before." Nuance. It's good. I alluded to China's success, and I don't think I'll belabor this, but we had a brief on this the other day, and it was striking. I'm not allowed to tell you who said this second quote, and I'll just leave it with this. "I found that a contract that would take 5 years to discuss, negotiate, and sign with the World Bank takes 3 years when we have dealt with the Chinese authorities. And they are moving in quickly, winning hearts and minds by providing health care, roads, and education. And with that then come educational exchanges and other kinds of assistance." And then you learn that the road is designed, the money donated for roads has just one stipulation. It has to be able to support a 300-ton tank. So it gives you an idea of what they're doing, and hey, who can blame them? But the fact that that works, and that the Chinese, with fewer resources than we have, albeit growing steeply, are putting that much into health care in dozens of spots around the world, indicates that they feel this is winning allies. Now, these next few quotes are from some documents that we have recently generated in the Pentagon, the Joint Forces Command Memorandum, the Army Field Manual, and the Navy Strategic Plan. So without bothering you about the service-specific details, this is what our thinking is now, not just health affairs, but the line leadership of the Pentagon. "Just as good health is an integral part of an individual's well-being, a viable health sector is vital to a nation's well-being. Demographic stress from large populations with diverse and opposing cultural backgrounds and poor human development are key contributors to social unrest, violent conflict, and state failure. Poverty is a fundamental cause of civil strife, poor health, and lack of vital services. States with high rates of infant mortality are at higher risk of civil conflict. A country's inability to meet expectations for improved quality of life can lead to decreased popular confidence, political instability, increased discontent, and civil strife." We sometimes repeat ourselves in the Pentagon just to make sure everybody's got the message. "Natural disasters, violence, and conflict can lead to a collapse in the public health system and restrict access to water, food, and health care, further jeopardizing the lives of the people and triggering fighting. When people start fighting over water, you've really got a problem." "Why emphasize the health sector and stability ops? Conflict itself disrupts the health services in a variety of ways. Destruction of infrastructure, such as the electrical grid in an urban area, or disrupted water distribution systems or damaged sanitation, promote the spread of disease." That doesn't mean that you go in and vaccinate people or give out ciprofloxacin or penicillin in preference to fixing the sewage. You obviously have to go in and try to get the electricity up, the clean water, the sewage, the roads. You have to have stability. You have to protect people's lives. But the lack of infrastructure certainly promotes disease. Thirdly, lack of public or private transportation or lack of a secure travel route limits population access to healthcare services. Damage to transportation infrastructure and commercial business prevent the normal flow of medical material to existing facilities. You can't get your drugs and your bandages and your syringes. And lastly, conflict disrupts the social and economic structures of a society, further limiting a population's resiliency and displacement of the host nation population groups from their homes magnifies these problems. So internal refugees and so forth. We saw all of this in Iraq. We still are struggling with this. And the great challenge there has been the great question for us is, was it an enormous mistake, even in retrospect, to try to deliver health services in Iraq before the shooting had stopped? Because we had a system where they had looted their own hospitals. People were afraid to drive across town to go to work or to go to the hospital to be a patient. The one person who could operate the CAT scanner was either killed or had fled the country, and so forth. If you add to that power outages, unclean water, shortages of supplies, hijacked supplies, corruption, you can imagine the picture. This was a very challenging time for us in Iraq, and we struggled with how to deliver any health services to the Iraqi people in such a situation. And I'll come back to this in a little bit. Why emphasize the health sector and stability ops? Military medical personnel are natural bridge builders and can often more easily communicate with the military and civilian stakeholders. Let me amplify that. This is DOD doctrine, but the fact is, in these countries, the doctors are often the only ones who speak English. And one of the problems, pros and cons of this situation, was that we had, in Iraq, doctors serving as our translators. They were great translators, but it deprived the Iraqi people of doctors. This was one of those unintended consequences. We just considered the first-order effect and not the second- and third-order effect of having a friendly Iraqi who spoke English and had some exposure to, you know, the way we thought. And maybe we made a mistake in that. Secondly, it's common for allied nations to contribute medical forces but not combatant forces to our operations, particularly in Afghanistan. And there we have learned that if, you know, the British, the Czechs, the Bulgarians, to some extent the Canadians and Australians, they're there for the full spectrum of operations. But there are many countries that really limit what their troops can do, but they certainly can deliver humanitarian aid and training, and we perhaps have not taken a full advantage of what they offer. Certainly, Dr. Gates is pushing hard on NATO to contribute more people who can deliver these soft power solutions. Capacity building. Military and civ-mil activities for health sector reconstruction should be designed to promote the legitimacy of the host nation and establish a healthcare infrastructure. Where we've made mistakes over the past decade in our when we send the Mercy or the Comfort, the big ships with the white ships with the Red Cross, we sometimes have this understandable physician pride. We want to fix the cleft lips, cleft palates, and so people, you know, feel halfway normal and acceptable. And it's a wonderful thing. The problem is it can embarrass the local doctor. And the local doctor can then be criticized by that village or that town, and then they may leave. So you get 1 week of feeling good about the operation you did on a child, and you've hurt that village for the next year. So we've that lesson has sunk in. Our point now is capacity building. I think most of you know this, but I'll say it for the record. I think this is a repeat of what we've already been saying, except the last sentence. We have learned also that we must send people over who have some cultural and linguistic fluency. They need to speak Arabic. They need to speak State Department. They need to speak WHO. There are some languages that we are teaching people to speak. It is not easy, particularly for a career military, to make that switch and start speaking NGO speak. It's just not the way we work, but we are learning. We hope that this will induce NGOs to work more with us. I'll tell you, I have to be frank, we struggled in Iraq and Afghanistan with understanding USAID. Several of you are here. Thank you for your forbearance, spies. We have to acknowledge that we have learned a lot from AID, and we've had trouble getting AID to recognize that we now are truly listening with both ears open. But since Dr. Anderson arrived, he has persuaded the AID people in the audience that we indeed are not there to take over their lane or just to use healthcare to go in and conduct intelligence operations under the guise of providing medical services. So we're indebted to Colonel Anderson for that. Learning to build a bridge to USAID. Okay. We have a number of areas we're working on. Disaster relief, hospital ships, increasing our cooperation, support of the IOs and the NGOs. You alluded to the work in Africa. I'll put $50 million this year into HIV drugs in Africa. And we're not the lead on that in the president's program for AIDS, but we certainly are supporting it. Let me give you a few examples. This is from our trip on the Comfort last summer. We went to 14 countries. Again, trying to build capacity, not just do prima donna operations. Trying to involve the local doctors, help them get up to speed, honor them, not embarrass them. And we put a lot of money into this. I put $250 million in the past couple years into hurricane relief, for example, both the United States and the tsunami. And we were very active in Hurricane Ike. Katrina, we got called in too late, I'm sorry, but we did. When they called for us, we were ready. Gustav, Hannah, and so forth. The earthquake in Peru, we were there. I was there personally, 49th hour after the earthquake. And naturally, that meant canceling a bunch of meetings. But when an assistant secretary arrives at the earthquake site from the U.S. before the neighboring country of Ecuador got its Red Cross there, and before the president of Peru got there, that that voting with your feet, it speaks volumes. And I was so glad I went to the Peru earthquake. I do it out of pride, so I can get there before the Red Cross and the Salvation Army and AID. It's kind of a race. I keep the duffel bag packed. But in this instance, the president of Peru, who had been strongly in the Chavez camp, came to the earthquake site to thank us for bringing DOD supplies and personnel to the earthquake, and called Ambassador McKinley and said, please tell President Bush that this is the first time that America's done us any good. So we were very, very pleased to make a difference in our relations with Peru. And it was just a matter of getting there a few hours before the others got there. Simple as that. And once we were there, we did a lot of aeromedical evacuation, medical logistics, a lot of supplies, treated a lot of patients. And frequently in these situations, we can do the heavy lifting. If we take a Chinook helicopter, we can lift things that nobody else in that country can lift. And they need our lift to deliver supplies, to move boulders out of the way, to get access to regions that are impassable and the like. So here from Hurricane Katrina, and then lower left in Peru delivering supplies, lower right in Ecuador building a clinic. And when you build a clinic and you put a gift of the American people on it, it's sometimes gets chiseled out, but at least for a while we have a calling card, and they have a clinic. This was in the tsunami. I'll say just a word about the tsunami, because I went to the tsunami very quickly. I was the first American doctor there, and I went there as I had gone to other disasters with my team, expecting to do a lot of teaching and to be able to do medical feats that they had only read of in books. Well, this is what I found when I got there. The lower left is a picture of an unfortunate cameraman who caught the tsunami full on. But the lower right, you know, one room of thousands of bodies in the Watts there, where the Buddhist monks tended them. And I just show this picture for 2 points. The photograph of the Thai soldier encapsulated that whole response. Here you had thousands of Westerners from Germany, Sweden, England, and France, U.S., vacationing there in Phuket, Thailand. And instead of the Westerners rescuing the people of color, it was the people of color rescuing the Westerners. And they did it splendidly. And when I got there, right after the tsunami, there was nothing left to do. The patients had been operated. The patients who were on ventilators were off the ventilator. And there were no infections. And I said, how did you do it? They said, well, we rehearse disasters, don't you? And I went, well, we do. And we're going to. And I said, how did you have people so crowded together in the refugee camps that there were no outbreaks of cholera or malaria? And they go, we don't shake hands. We don't shake hands. And in our disasters, of course, people are shaking hands and hugging and so forth, spreading germs. And in Thailand, of course, they keep their distance. It was a huge lesson. The crib sheet for the my students there on the right, a mnemonic about how we prepare for disasters and so forth. And I just say one other thing about the tsunami, because I learned so much more there than I expected. They were very successful in their response to this enormous disaster. You know, 150,000 dead in the whole tsunami, 8,000 in Thailand. But they had a well-developed public health system. They had rehearsed their disaster plans. They rapidly implemented a low-cost, simple disease surveillance program. And they had some other cultural features. They disliked conflict and loud voices. And this is tremendously helpful in a disaster situation. No one was shouting. Everyone was calmly waiting their turn to speak. Secondly, they had in their in Thailand, they have a redundancy of communications. And they have an extraordinary volunteerism. The monks were extremely active. And I think I'll leave it at that. Those were the unusual features. But the most extraordinary response to a disaster that I've seen. again, for our students, military and civilian, we have very few people for whom disaster response or humanitarian assistance is their full-time job. So we give them little crib sheets they can use when they go into an area. And there's some of the things that are not obvious to you. Blackberries work better than cell phones. It's important to have cash. It's absolutely critical that the local businesses be sustained by giving cash. The way that one treats the way that one assists in the treatment of the dead in these countries is almost as important in establishing relationships as the way you treat the wounded. Let me say a couple words about our hospital ships. The Mercy, over the past 2 years, has treated 260,000 patients around the world. The Comfort, last summer, we treated 98,000 patients, and we assisted in Hurricane Katrina. The Boxer, 24,000 in Guatemala. We could go on and on. The Peleliu in Vietnam and so forth. Let me just say, and this lower left is the president of Peru, and with me is the joint staff surgeon, Dave Smith. Little things count. Even kids who, you know, one soccer ball can keep a whole bunch of kids playing and out of their mother's hair. And when the mother is getting treatment and there's nobody around, father may be dead, a simple soccer ball outside the clinic does wonders for crowd control, for harmony, and so forth. Let me just say, the sight of the Comfort or the Mercy, this is the Comfort, coming into port, this was in Ecuador, it draws an enormous crowd. People will walk for 200 miles for an operation on that boat. People will walk for 200 miles for an operation. It's an extraordinary thing. This has led Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, to ask which is the more powerful ship. We, of course, pleased with that comparison. Let me say a word about the Amar Foundation and say how glad I am that its founder and chief, Baroness Emma Nicholson, is here. Amar Foundation is, although she is from the European Parliament and the British Parliament, Amar is a private foundation which has done the things in Iraq that we could not do. I alluded earlier to the fact that when I was in Iraq, I think I could fairly be said to have failed in improving the health care of Iraq, even though that was my job as the ranking medical officer for General Casey for Iraq Health. But the Baroness has trained women to take care of other women, and now they see 30,000 patients a month in Baghdad, 25,000 patients a month outside of Baghdad. They do it for pennies, and they have gone around a Ministry of Health, which previously was obstructive and corrupted, but now is an advocate of what Amar Foundation is doing. So this is, we have learned from them, we've learned from CARE and Red Cross, of course, but particularly from MR Foundation in this very difficult part of the world, Iraq. A couple other examples. We have learned enormous amounts from our British colleagues. They have taught us a great deal because they learned their lessons as a global power, you know, 100 years ago, and they have kept those lessons, and they passed them on, and they've passed a lot of them on to us. So we have a lot of meetings learning from our British colleagues, from the UN, WHO, lower right. Let me just mention the guy up the top, General Samir, Brigadier General Dr. Abdul Hassan Samir, is the Surgeon General of Iraq and was a colleague over there. And he confided in me one story, which I'll leave you with, one of my favorite stories. He said, "I was your enemy." I said, "That's hard to believe." He said, "Oh, yes, I was your enemy. I was one of Saddam's, you know, bright young colonels. And we went into hiding when you came. But I was injured. and I was treated in an American facility. I said, well, that's nice. He said, yes, but you know what? I said, what, Dr. Samir? He said, I am now part American. I said, well, that's very nice. He said, I don't think you understand. I said, what? He said, I said, okay, well, explain. He said, I have American blood in me. I said, really? You know, someone with a grandparent was over in the U.S.? No, no. I had 6 units of your blood, and now I'm changed forever. I'm changed forever with American blood in me. Never forget that story. Afghanistan, a tougher deal, a poorer country. Dr. Gates has said Afghans are considering America as liberators who are in Afghanistan to help bring peace, stability, and prosperity. That is true in the main, but a small number of people don't want us there, and they have a very and they're very active. Let me just say that in Afghanistan, our need, let me just skip to, I'll skip the Iraq story. That's proving to be a big success now, but I'd be happy to answer questions on it. These are public documents. The Government Accountability Office and the Inspector General have both pointed out in the last few months that the Defense Department has more work to do in developing unified plans with our interagency partners. It's their opinion, and I agree with it, that we can do more for the health of Afghanistan, and it requires a better plan. So I have to acknowledge that we do not at this time have, we do not at this time know what works in the building up of a healthcare program for Afghanistan. We absolutely know that Afghans are constituting about 80% of our hospital beds. It's difficult to support that. We need them to have their own system. Particularly their police have virtually no health care, and because of that, their police have trouble recruiting new police. So they desperately need a better health care system. This is something that General Petraeus and I are working on, and it's becoming it's moving toward the front burner. As always, we welcome insights from people in this audience, some of you who have spent a lot more time in Afghanistan than I have. So I'll skip over that because I've summarized these concepts. But let me just say that sitting at the Revolutionary Palace in Iraq one night when we were barred from visiting the Minister of Health, this was 2.5 years ago under the previous ministry, and we were losing about 4 or 5 soldiers a day, and there were about 120 Iraqi bodies found every morning. The hospitals had become killing zones. We desperately were looking for something we could do to improve health care in Iraq that wouldn't require any ministerial help. And we came up with the idea that there were cell phones that people had and that we could reach them to deliver some health education. And this idea was born in Iraq, but it's being put to use now in Africa. And Dr. Akhila Kasaraju, where are you, Dr. Kasaraju? Here is the genius behind this. And Dr. Kasaraju has had a number of exciting conferences on this. Absolutely electrified, I think, the public health community with the potential of a simple cell phone being used for health education, just-in-time medical consultation, surveillance, and alerts. Tsunami coming your way. Bird flu coming your way, cholera coming your way, these kinds of alerts, terribly important. And she's partnering in this with Voxiva, Qualcomm, other companies. We're delighted to have them as partners in this. In Afghanistan alone, a country of about 30 million people, but who knows exactly, there are 4 million cell phones. So there is a potential, even in Afghanistan, for using cell phones to improve health at a variety of levels. And I won't belabor that. Mistakes and lessons learned. We've learned that we weren't working closely enough with the international organizations and the non-government organizations. We are amending our ways. I said before, when doctors roll into developing areas with dazzling technologies, if they upstage the local doctors, that's a big mistake. Short-term gain, long-term mistake. Medical reconstruction is difficult when fighting is going on, particularly, and we're still struggling with what you can do while the fighting is still going on. Obviously, reconstruction requires roads, electricity, running water, and sanitation before you can deliver sophisticated health care. But you have to have a plan. You know, when roads are when you have only so many roads and so much electricity, no sanitation, and some potable water, what can you do? And then as the situation improves, security improves, transportation improves, what more can you do? This is the plan that we need to develop for Afghanistan. So let me just say, I have 2 points I want to make. One is that I've got a book here that I recently published called When It Mattered Most. It's a tribute to the 210 medics and corpsmen, one doctor and several nurses who have died in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are the people who get up when everyone else is ducking for cover. When the call comes, corpsman, medic up. Corpsman up, medic forward. They get up, say a little prayer, and run through the hail of bullets. Collect that person and try to bring them back. On their shoulder, in their arms, very vulnerable time. Many of them have been shot in that process. And many of them, and I've earmarked a bunch of them for the recipient of this book, have lost their lives saving Iraqis or Afghans. I won't read you their stories. I cannot read them comfortably, even in private. But I do want to give this book to the person who got me into this job, who persuaded me as a university professor that the military was not a bunch of knuckle-dragging breakers and destroyers of things, but actually had some interesting things going on. I ended up joining the Army Reserve myself and serving in Iraq. But the person who's been prodding me to do all this is one of your very own, and now one of our Defense Health Board members, Ray Dubois. Ray, would you please come forward and accept this book? I'm not giving you this podium. You've had this podium plenty of times. I know I won't get it back, so I'm going to hold you at arm's length and just say in closing that one of the things I am absolutely sure about that we have learned, that we have taught in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere, is something that only the American military, I think, can teach. And that is, when a platoon comes into your village, a village which has known the military only as someone who came to beat you up, to take your money, or to take your daughter, and that military comes into your town and vaccinates your children, pulls your bad tooth, treats the animals that are so much a source of your economy, and leaves without asking for anything, and they talk and they say, you know, those soldiers, they were young and old, black, white, Asian. Their names were O'Brien, Ali, Cohen, and Chang, and they didn't even fight among themselves or with us. This is a lesson that is never lost on any village or town in Iraq, and it's something that has stayed with me and been the honor of a lifetime to work with these terrific young people who do all this hard work. So, Ray, again, I want to say thank you. Steve Morrison, thank you for having me. Thank you for CSIS for taking an interest in global health. I hope I've talked so long that there will be no questions, but I have some smart people who can answer them. Thank you very much.
Just despite your fondest wishes, we do have time for questions.
Oh, darn it.
So if you may stay up there or take a seat, whichever you prefer. And I'll reach out to the audience to see if anyone has a question. Ann.
Hi, I'm Ann Richard from the International Rescue Committee, an international non-governmental organization. And I think you should tell your wife that you did do a good job as a public speaker in getting your views across in a very informative and sometimes entertaining way. You know, working at an NGO, I think we're very concerned about your goal to work more closely with NGOs in places where we both end up working. On natural disasters, it's not as big an issue because that's where the it doesn't have to be contentious, and that's where the military's fantastic lift capacity and speed married with NGO know-how and sometimes local contacts can really be can make a difference in a life-saving way. But in the what you call theater operations in wartime, in these very hostile, insecure environments right now, when there's a request for NGOs to work very closely with the military, we're very, very uncomfortable about that. We don't want to do it. Most NGOs, not all of them 100%, but most of the mainstream, large U.S.-based NGOs, because it undermines our own security. It makes it confusing about who is a soldier and who is an aid worker. It's a very expensive way for you to deliver some of these, some of this care when we can do it much, much cheaper. And sometimes what we've found is that military folks who do have the personnel and very highly motivated, enthusiastic, smart, agile personnel don't have the training, though, for these types of situations. And so in the spirit that you brought today of sort of speaking very candidly and openly, I wanted to make sure that we put this out because, you know, when you show a picture of a soldier sharing soccer balls with kids, that's great, of course. That's, you know, everyone here is affected by that. But it may not be the best interest of the U.S. as a whole to be having soldiers deployed to do that when it could be aid workers from a very different background. Thank you.
Yeah, points very well taken. This, we welcome your ideas, either to Dr. Anderson or myself, on how we can, where exactly we're weak. In the general problem, we completely acknowledge what, where are our, you know, we often assign to you basically 18, 19-year-old escorts for security or for lift, and what are they doing or saying that frustrates your plans or that seem to implicate you as a combatant almost, and you want to be a completely nonpartisan person in a combat zone? This is a very big problem for us, and it in the early days in Iraq, we simplified it. I mean, it was simplified for us by the fact that there was the bombing in the Al Rashid. You know, UN left. You know, Red Cross got caught up in their own corruption issues. Well, there was only us. So we learned to do some things that we had never done before. We need to learn which of those you can do and under what arrangements, because we, as Dr. Gates has said, we're not the Peace Corps with guns. There's some things that we can do if we have to, but we're not going to do them as well as people who do them all the time. You've gotten your NGO people who've been to 10 or 20 humanitarian disasters. We've got kids who've been to none or one. So we certainly, the first lesson, I think, is for our kids to walk humbly and have their eyes open, their ears open. But they are in, they're trained, basic training, you know, follow orders. And they get in an NGO situation, which is more nuance and conflict between NGOs. Man, they are frustrated. Our kids are frustrated. It's worthy of whole all-day conferences to figure that out. I don't, Dr. Anderson, do you have an answer to that? You got the microphone there.
That, this on. That question's very well taken. In Iraq in 2003, I was among the first into Baghdad, and immediately I was with the public health team. First thing we started doing was meeting with the International Red Cross, and we had to meet almost in the dead of night under cover of darkness because the Red Cross was, you know, if they were seen with us, then that was a big deal. And I have a photograph of some light-armored vehicles parked out in front of the Red Cross building. When we went there during the daytime, the Red Cross was kind of upset with that. A few days later, two Red Cross volunteers or two Red Cross workers were murdered in Baghdad after we started talking with them. And what were we talking about? Well, we were talking about where people needed water and you know, where they needed antibiotics and things. So, you know, we understand that the perception is more important in some regards than what's actually going on in the process. The second thing I want to say is that when we started standing up the Ministry of Health, there were some NGOs there in addition to the Red Cross. One was CARE International. And I remember talking with Margaret Hassan and her assistant, Majid, a chemist, and he was saying to me, you Americans don't understand what you've done here, what forces of darkness you've unleashed by toppling Saddam. Yeah, he needed to go, but you're not putting enough people in here to handle security. And, of course, I'm, you know, like, yeah, sure, whatever. You know, we've got it. We're the Americans. We got control over this thing. And, you know, within months, Margaret Hassan was murdered on YouTube. And her image is never far from my consciousness. Having said that, we have Dr. Cassells has provided a grant to hire NGO specialists. So we have somebody from the NGO world who speaks NGO. So we're very careful about that, and we want to make sure that we engage with the NGOs correctly. And frankly, I actually belong to the Indian Health Service, which is a pretty big, some people would argue, an NGO. But certainly seems like it when it comes to funding. But so that's sort of my background, too. But I want to say, finally, that there are a goodly number of major NGOs that are working with us. And if you don't know about it, I'm glad, because that's the idea. In Anbar province, for example, we just recently, within the last 6 months, had a huge continuing education program put on by an NGO. And we gave them the money to do it, but we didn't tell them what to do. We simply provided the money. We had a really good outcome from it, a really good outcome. And it was a huge issue for stability because it was done by an NGO through the government of Iraq. So it was Defense Department money, went to an NGO. The NGO provided it to the government of Iraq, provided the expertise. It was a win-win-win situation. So I would submit that we're learning how to work with NGOs almost by appearing not to work with them. And we hope to hone those skills in the future. So thank you.
Questions?
Steve?
Thank you very much for your extended remarks. The two points. One is, could you say something about the labs, and the special assets with respect to science and research, particularly on neglected tropical diseases? And the second thing is, we know that you're under pressure now with the new regulations around stability operations and the mandate to really make health programs part of those and to come up with more of a more unified and coherent vision. Right now, it seems that there's quite a balkanization of authorities and programs and the like spread across the different component parts of the U.S. military. My question there is, what is the game plan for trying to bring about a greater coherence and strategy for training and deploying and putting in place a much better system than exists today to meet that mandate?
Thanks, Steve Morrison. The first question about the labs, as you know, we have a big Army lab in Thailand and in Kenya, big Navy labs in Peru and Cairo, for example, and they are focusing on helping those populations train up in healthcare, public health, infectious diseases. And it's fantastic because frequently the Minister of Health of those countries is somebody that we've helped train. And their militaries train in our labs, so that improves our military-to-military trust. In terms of what good they have done as canaries in the coal mine for bird flu or as providers of malaria samples and so forth, I'm not sure. Ambassador Lang could probably tell you better. There are many, many global sensors that he studies. So the DOD overseas labs are among them. And as for the SSTRO, command and control issues, the interagency infighting, I've delegated that to Anderson. You know, because he'll be staying on. You know, I'll be only a few months in the new Obama administration, maybe 6 months. Who knows? And the career people who have this kind of training, Indian Health Service, military service in Iraq, experience with many disasters. They're the backbone of the Pentagon's effort here. It's not the political guys like me are meant to take the risks and take the fall if they fail. But the career people with the institutional knowledge are really required to find common ground with USAID and other agencies. And it's so far succeeding for us. I'm very proud of the DOD International Health team. I think they're doing a splendid job. I think, they don't pay too much attention to what the statutes are. They just want to help, They want to learn, they want to help. And we've gotten in trouble with DOD when we've either been arrogant or seemed arrogant. So we've learned from that. We're taking pains not even to seem it. And they're making a success of it. Certainly, just the communication with the AID. Let me tell you, I hadn't succeeded there as I hadn't succeeded in Iraq. But you learn from your mistakes. You hire the people who can do a better job than you can.
Thank you very much, Dr. Casalza, for your leadership. I want to ask you about the bigger question that you alluded to in the beginning about the connection between security and health and what it means for the Defense Department. We can understand, and the issues are complex enough, when we talk about health reconstruction in Iraq or Afghanistan where the U.S. has combat operations. But when you talk about infant mortality as a predictor of instability or the other factors in that slide about the connection between health and security, what do you see in the long term as the Defense Department's role in health in countries where the United States has no military operations, either in cases where we have no particular other security interest or in countries, for example, in the Horn of Africa, where we have security interests but very different than where we have combat operations? How far do we take security as a justification for a Defense Department role?
Mr. Rubenstein, who, by the way, is president of Physicians for Human Rights, we don't want to militarize social problems internationally or medicalize them, either one. That kind of hubris is not our intent. And so our role is really to go in there and do some international things under just really specific circumstances. It's got to be a place where we have a national interest. And that national interest, broadly defined, could be a humanitarian interest, particularly if it's some place where we really need to be recognized as the good guys. Secondly, we have to go in where only we can go, where there's shooting, and where very few NGOs will venture. Although, let's face it, in Darfur and some places, the NGOs have been utterly fearless where there's tribal warfare. Some of them have been extraordinarily courageous. But when the shooting gets too hot, most of the NGOs are gone. We can get in there if told to do so by the president. And then our job is to try to get some reconstruction going, find some heroes among the locals, let the cream rise to the top, and you know, so the thing will snowball. But not, we don't have to stay till the ribbon is cut, but rather just get something started. You know, you might call it pump priming or some catalytic role, and get out, because we really don't have the money, and we don't want to incur dependency. We want to do just enough so they can take it and run with it. We take the training wheels off as soon as we can. That's up to the commanders on the ground, and you know, I try not to second guess them as a policy matter. They make mistakes. You know, the big picture is up to the president. We're going to see what President Obama wants to do with this. My bet is, from his public statements, that he is interested in soft power. Soft power is kind of new for the Defense Department. I mean, there was the Berlin airlift, you know, but medical soft power, medical diplomacy is new for us. It's less than 2 years old. If President Obama asks us to do more in that realm, of course, you know, we will. And we will make mistakes, and trust that you will call us to account. And, you know, we make ethical mistakes. We make social and cultural mistakes. And we try to learn from them. We appreciate the pushback from your organization and AID and others who have not been afraid to stand up to the Defense Department. Does us good, frankly.
We are running low on time. We have time for about two more questions, and I'm going to use my moderator's prerogative to ask one of them. That is, you know, as you look to, as you said, you'll be there for several months, perhaps longer. What do you think are the biggest challenges in this realm facing the next administration? What is the unfinished business in terms of the Defense Department and global health that you hope will be accomplished in the next 4 years?
Thanks. I think it's figuring out a U.S. government plan and a NATO plan for Afghanistan. But I do think that we are going to be called upon, if I read the tea leaves correctly, to reach out to Pakistan and maybe even to Iran. My guess is those would be in the form of exchanges, scientific or medical exchanges, exchange visits, perhaps starting with meetings in another country. But for Pakistan, for example, we're already talking about partnerships between their military medical school and ours. Could that be broadened? I think it could be. Pakistan is a very complicated place right now. I would say even more complicated than Afghanistan, because in Afghanistan they're so poor, you can certainly do some good with resources. Pakistan doesn't need the resources as much as they need some technological input here or there and some symbolic support. A very tricky situation. Iran, you know, there are scads of Iranian doctors and scientists who want to work with people in this country and who are right now constrained from doing so. We were unable to help in the BAM earthquake in Iran. That's a pity. For this, we need to take our lead from the new administration. That's a high-level policy decision. It's not, you know, a doctor's job is a technical job, really, and that's a policy question.
Last question, and wave them back there. Yes, please. Yes, you.
Yeah, thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much. My name is Winston Allen. I'm with the Africa's Health in 2010 project, which is run by Academy for Educational Development. And thank you for a very great presentation. I know you focused a lot on the areas where there's conflict, rightly so. But then on one of the slides, you also mentioned Africa and the role that cell phones can play. And then in Africa also, you do have countries which are just basically poor and fragile. And then you also have countries which are going through some form of conflict. And I was just wondering, as you look forward in a similar way, what do you see as the role of the Defense Department in health in Africa?
Well, fortunately, I think first thing I want to invite you to the conference that we're having tomorrow and the next day. Dr. Anderson is having the first ever conference on the health aspects of the Africa Command, the whole potential there, and what, you know, the continent is enormous. The needs are, you know, it's Afghanistan multiplied by 20, with poverty and conflict, and yet areas of enormous opportunity and hope. The surgeon for the Africa Command is in the audience, so I want to make that introduction, Dr. Schuyler Geller. And Dr. Geller, if you could you answer that question either now or in private if you prefer? I don't want to put you on the spot, but he's only in charge of health care for the whole continent. So it's the miracle of the fishes and the loaves. His budget would cover a portion of Waldorf or La Plata, Maryland, but he's got the whole continent he's responsible for. Colonel Geller.
Thank you. I believe there are enormous opportunities. We, as Africa Command, are now inheriting the presence of Central Command, Pacific Command, and European Command's previous efforts. Most of the planning for that which is ongoing this year are activities that were planned by those three separate commands. We are in the process of our first year of planning and have been able to partner with many organizations. Africa Command is an interagency command and is over 50% civilian billets within it. We have just had the opportunity to work with USAID's pandemic response, and we'll be engaging the militaries in developing pandemic influenza response plans in support of USAID's country response plans that have already been developed. Will be ongoing this spring. There are many ongoing exercises that are training, professionalizing the medics within African militaries, and have engaged with the Surgeons General of the various nations, asking what it is that we can do in support of them. One recent effort is in the area of training paraprofessionals. There's an enormous brain drain in Africa. It's not that Africa doesn't train adequate numbers of physicians. There are many medical schools in Africa that are generating numbers of physicians, but those physicians leave because there is instability. There's a lack of a way to actually practice their craft in the way that they want to. And so the militaries that depend on those physicians for support frequently find themselves wanting. We've just developed brigades in Liberia that have just finally Liberia is able to defend itself after the 19-year civil war. But the number of medics, it's a very paltry few medics, and trying to assist with developing those military medics is one of our current projects. So there's lots of opportunities. I'd love to talk with you more afterwards, but I don't want to take more time. Thank you.
I just want to conclude.
Steve. Steve, could you come with just one small gift for you from the secretary here? There's a coin that we have. We call them challenge coins or coins of excellence, commander's coins. This is one that the president himself cannot take away if I give it to you. You probably have lots of four-star coins, but here's one you don't have.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, and I want you all to join me in thanking Dr. Cassells. Thank you very much.